begin.
Okay.
My name is Barbara Sikora. Today's date is Thursday, February 11th, 2010. I'm interviewing Eric Miles about his military career. We can just start pretty generally. You can tell me a little bit about yourself, just where you're from or where you want to begin, if you want to begin as a baby or the day you wrote your name down and enlisted. Well, how old were you when you enlisted, by the way?
I was 21 years old.
21 years
old. Yes. I started here in Frankfort, Kentucky, is where I was born and raised.
Oh, you were?
And so school, college didn't really agree with me that much, and an opportunity came up to explore the National Guard. One of my softball buddies, he was a recruiter, and he just shared some stories about it, what was going on there, and invited me to take a test. So I came out and took a test in 81, and then enlisted there for the Kentucky National Guard, and stayed with the Kentucky Guard almost my entire career.
Oh,
and I had an interesting opportunity to get in the medical field. First 16 years, I was a medical maintenance technician.
Was there medical people in your family?
No, there wasn't.
Was there military people in your family?
Yeah, my couple of uncles were in the Army. I had another uncle that was in the Navy. And kind of grew up with them, and I wasn't a really big military buff, but I did like the challenge. I was pretty athletic, so I thought this would be a good opportunity to, you know, escape my hometown and get to see the world.
Yeah.
So, and I stayed in the Guard, not in medical the entire time, but I went into logistics and recruiting, you know, and kind of touched a broad base of some of what the military has to offer, and retired there full time last February.
You're a retiree.
Yes.
You're into your second career now.
Exactly.
Well, what kind of work did you do with the medical? What exactly is a...
Well, my job was what they call in civilian, it's biomedical equipment repair technician. What we do is train to repair the equipment, to train to track the equipment through its life history, try to preserve it as long as we can. Mm-hmm. We train technicians and just do malfunction function analysis and assist the medical personnel with all the equipment throughout the hospital and just track it and do a lot of upkeep.
Where were you trained
history.
Initially?
Well,
where was your boot camp?
My boot camp was actually in Alabama. I went in August of 81 to Fort McClellan and actually left there in October, started at Denver, Colorado, which was my training base for. It was the United States Army Military Equipment, Medical Equipment, and Optical School training base they had out there.
How long were you out there then?
Well, I had two stints. The initial phase was 19 weeks. That was, starting in October and February. After I got it, straight after basic training. And then after that, I came back to my National Guard unit and trained, actually still attended school, Kentucky State University, and worked at Sears, and then went back about another 18 months to complete the second phase, which is advanced 30 weeks in Denver, Colorado. And after I came back from there, I was fortunate enough to get a full-time job working at Humana Hospital University for a couple of years in their medical maintenance staff.
Where is that?
It's in Louisville.
In Louisville.
Mm-hmm. You ever heard of Dr. DeVries,
the heart
surgeon?
Guy.
Yeah, that was when all that stuff was going on there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a huge new facility, and it was pretty exciting to work there at the time.
What were the options they gave you out of boot camp, what you might want to be in, or did they give you any options and say, you're going to go into this field?
That is determined before you even sign the contract. My friend who I played softball with, he lets you know your options after you take the test. That opens up the field of what you're qualified to go into. And
were you surprised that this was one of the choices?
It was interesting because I went to Kentucky State as computer science.
Oh.
And being in the software portion of it, I'm usually turned out to be more apt at hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went ahead and started at Kentucky State in programming, and that was kind of dry, you know, and didn't really take to that too much. But this year was a little bit challenging. It was electronics, something that was a little bit challenging. And so I went in there and I knew I'd get to turn wrenches. So that kind of worked out pretty good. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good choice.
That's a field that really evolves. Did you have to go back for periodically for training all the time when new equipment came out?
Yeah, so depending on what assignments we had, what new equipment we got into different facilities I've been involved with over the years, we'd have to go back to the manufacturer for the training. Or they would come to us sometime and train us, you know, different times. Mm-hmm. So it involved medical equipment, dental equipment, and just computers in general, basically then. So now, coincidentally, I'm trying to get an opportunity to get Microsoft certified. And so that kind of brings me back to the software portion when I started my career. So I think I'm a little bit more up to it right now. Uh-huh. I'm going to give that a try. And then with the hardware and troubleshooting background, I think it'll become a lot easier to me and be more interesting. I'm going to give that a shot.
What'd your family think when you signed the dotted line that you were going into the Guard?
Well, they were kind of glad to see that. They knew my heart wasn't in college. And
how many years had you been in college?
Let's see, probably 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kind of faded away from the computer stuff and then went to just a general curriculum. Mm-hmm. And just kind of floating around. Didn't see anything that really turned me on. So the military had this deal and the option to get college at a later time and date, which I never kind of got busy with my military career. I never did really get to finish my my studies. I did get an associate's degree, with the bulk of that being through the 19 and 30 week period of training there in Denver, Colorado, Fitzsimmons Army Medical Center.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you were for 10 years. You were doing this work all around the country, or pretty much?
Well, 16 years.
I was thinking before Desert Storm.
Well, after I left Humana University, Hospital University, I worked there from 84 to 86. And then I came on board full time here in Frankfort with a medical field dental detachment. And so I worked with them for.
You were back home.
Back home, yeah. Get off the road, didn't have to commute as much.
Uh-huh.
And so we went ahead and set that unit up. I was the first full-time maintenance guy they'd had there, and we got that flowing. And then an opportunity came up with the original unit that I came on board with. I was recruited for the 475th MASH. And so that unit there I came back to probably 10 months prior to Operation Desert Storm coming up. So that unit got mobilized and had an incident where I had a reaction to all the inoculations that we had prior to ramping up to go, and almost missed deployment. I was almost classified as non-deployable. And a good friend, Dr. Dobner, Joseph Dobner was our commander at that time. He analyzed it, and I ended up going on with them because my only option was to lay back and recover and then wait till I got a full blessing, full health to deploy, but then my unit would have been already gone, and I'd probably have to just join up with any other unit.
So you were with the 475th MASH.
Yes, that's
my
original unit.
There's a huge picture of them up there. I wonder if you're in there.
What year was the picture taken?
It was the Desert Storm picture.
Oh, well, I'm pretty sure I'm in there.
Oh, we'll have to check that out before you leave. That's pretty interesting. It's about 4 feet by 6 feet.
Oh, really?
Right in the front, right in the very front wall.
Okay, yeah, I'll check that out.
Yeah.
If there was a reason why I wasn't in there, it's because being full-time, we miss a lot of the gatherings and some of the meetings, working behind the scenes, getting things prepared and ready to roll, and sometimes we'll be away from the unit when some of the, you know, different events
the
take place.
The photo ops take place.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But I was going to say that...
Well, so you were sick as a dog when you had to ship out?
Oh, yeah, I really was. They thought it was Lyme disease. I gathered fluid on my ankle and my knee and my elbow. It was kind of like seized at the moment.
And that is sort of Lyme disease.
Yeah, that was one of their suspicions what it was. But eventually, you know, it kind of went away.
I
healed
in
up
country,
while I was there.
Or?
It was in Iraq, you know, and I was really, really still, you know, couldn't use my arm that much. But I managed, and I had to take a shot of dexamethasone. It was a steroid that's supposed to last about 6 weeks, and eventually I recovered from with the help of that. And so I was back to full strength by the time we redeployed. But the other stint I had after the came on board full-time with the 973rd Dental, deployed with the 475th MASH. We got back in April of 91, and then I went to took a full-time job in Camp Shelby, Mississippi, with the regional training site.
Oh.
Yeah, these new hospital systems we had, they call them DepMeds, Deployable Medical Hospitals.
Oh.
And you would could configure them from a field hospital, small, all the way up to a general hospital. And so we trained all kind of units there at Camp Shelby, Mississippi. I was there from March 92 until April 1996 when I returned back to Kentucky, to reunite with my family. And so I went with the reserves, another hospital outfit, one in Lexington, one in Louisville, for about an 18-month period. And then I came back on as a full-timer with the Kentucky Army National Guard.
Is that pretty typical to move from one unit to another within?
It depends. Yeah, it's not odd.
Where they need you?
Yeah, where you need them. Where you're as a reservist or National Guard, you know, your civilian life usually dictates, you know, your where you go and set up. We have a lot of people that really like their home units, but as they go across the country, across the world with their civilian career, sometimes they'll like that unit so much that they'll just commute in, you know, fly in just that one month for training or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them, you know, if they don't get full-time careers with the National Guard or reserve units, then they'll just, you know, go where the other opportunities are. You know, they'll go from one job to another. If they're not satisfied with that team or with that job, they'll migrate to, you know, things that fit their lifestyle better.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me what happened when you told your family you were going off to meet Saddam.
Well, that was a big shock to everybody, including us. Usually the selection for which units deploy is depending on the needs of the big army. It's a nickname they always say, big army. So with us being unique, a MASH unit, Kentucky was, I think, about in the transition stages to go more away from combat services support, which is what we're classified as, to just generals. More frontline activity, artillery units, armor units, which is tanks, and different things like that. That would put us in the forefront and right in the fray of the battle, and so that's where they was on paper headed to.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were one of the few units selected to participate in Operation Desert Storm from Kentucky. And that was something that was a surprise, I guess, to the Kentucky Guard and, you know, overall. It was quite an honor for us and, you know, a lot of the other units that
how many
didn't
were in
get
the
to
unit?
Go. We had approximately, actually the MTO required, I think, about 450 personnel. Of course, we didn't have that many people with the unit at the time, you know. And so of the people that we did have, it may have been of 50% of that 450. Certain ones weren't able to deploy because of family care items or
50%?
Yes, 50%. And that's not out of the norm. Because of demands, training, equipment and funds. You don't usually see that many units of that type fully manned, full strength, and ready to go to war at that particular time, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we pulled from other reserve units, from active duty units, to actually fill those slots before we could go ahead and deploy. Some of them we met up with at Fort Knox as we went through the deployment process. Some of them we met later in country. And so
we went to Fort Knox and then right to Kuwait?
That was our deployment slot. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
What was it like when you got off into that? Was it hot?
No, because we went in wintertime.
Yeah.
It wasn't. We actually got in country probably the second week in, actually, I want to say, should have been the first week in January.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't that much longer that they actually, you know, took off in the fight began. Mm-hmm. And it was a relatively short war. Didn't have a lot of resistance there.
How long were you in Kuwait? You had to sort
Well, we didn't go to Kuwait. We went to Iraq.
You did go to
Iraq. Mm-hmm. Yeah, southern Iraq.
Southern Iraq.
And then we went up to
up into
northern We didn't actually ever get there.
That's right.
It was our mission to support First Cavalry. And the war went so quick, and there was so little resistance because the troops of Saddam were so, you know, mentally worn out, and they were just seized. It might have been the grace of God or whatever, but if he had have attacked us, you know, down there in southern Iraq where we were still trying to set up, you know, there wasn't been much we could do. It really been a good long fight then,
yeah.
His troops were surrendering so easily, and things were happening in our favor. You know, we were able to, you know, go in and attack, secure Kuwait, and then move on up into Iraq, you know, tackle the, what is the name of the elite guard he had?
The Royal
Elite. It was another term for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, his strongest forces were pretty easy pickings for, you know, our active duty forces. And so there wasn't much to do. We really didn't pull any casualties from the first cavalry because they never got into the fray. It was over so quick. So when we went out, we launched with 20,000 body bags, and we had many more ready, you know, to order just in case we needed them. But I think we ended up taking almost as many casualties from the Republican Guard.
Republican.
Republican Guard and some of the other forces that they had.
So you helped out the enemy.
We really did. Yeah. Yeah.
They
were hungry.
Like?
They were demoralized. They were cold, and they weren't interested in working for Saddam Hussein anymore. So yeah, that was.
Was that kind of weird for you, or did you?
Well, I mean, he was. You listened to Saddam Hussein, and he was talking about this is going to be the mother of all wars.
Uh-huh.
And so we were ramping up for the mother of all wars, like it was going to be World War III, the start and launch. But it turned out quite the opposite, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were really, really fortunate, and. I wish that this war that we're in now had been, you know, just a little bit more efficient.
What do you think? Do you think Schwarzenegger should have kept going? Schwarzkopf should have kept going and gotten him so that we wouldn't have...
Everybody believes that, yeah.
You think so, too?
I think so. I don't think we'd be in... We may be in Afghanistan, fully engaged and focused now,
mm-hmm.
but... I don't think we would have been over there in Iraq
mm-hmm.
at all. We wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, there wouldn't have been any, you know, necessity to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought back all your people. You were all dressed up. No place to go, really.
Yeah.
So you were just there a little bit and came up back home.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yes.
How long did it take you to get undeployed or unemployed? I'm not sure what the term would be.
There's a long wait. And the medical maintenance folks and the logistics folks, they're the ones that are assigned for the property and responsible for the tracking of the kit condition of the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So we sent our equipment over early, and then we got the personnel back home and reset up camp to take care of the soldiers after we got back to Kentucky. We had to wait on the equipment to be shipped back to us. And then there the inventories began, and then the inspections began, and all of that stuff. So
well,
it was really
was anything messed up because of the conditions over there? Any of the equipment? The sand or any of that?
Well, yeah, it was more like dust. I really wouldn't like your traditional sand. It's kind of like living in a dust bowl. The equipment held up quite well. It was new. Everything that we had was new. Even our vehicles, the hospital unit itself, you know,
mm-hmm.
hadn't been sitting around. It usually, you have more degradation of the status of the equipment in storage.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It wasn't too long after that, they had humidification controlled storage areas that they pre-positioned equipment in. Even that stress from all the equipment, just sitting,
mm-hmm.
you know, the dry rotting of the rubber and the degradation.
Mm-hmm.
Any equipment, vehicles especially, and all that stuff, is if it's not totally stored airtight and sealed, you know, then it's gonna start to, you know, deteriorate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was a good thing that we got to use our equipment. You know, it's better for us to have it over there and use it than it is to have it stored and everything. So that wasn't so bad. We didn't really... see a lot of stress and strain on the equipment from being over there. You
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
just had to be blowed out and
mm-hmm.
get the dust out.
Were you among the people that marched down Pennsylvania Avenue?
Yes, I was. And we,
were you? What was that
New York City?
No, Washington.
Okay, we was in the Washington Parade and
mm-hmm.
also in New York City, ticker tape
really?
Parade. Mm-hmm, yes.
What'd you feel about that?
time was awesome. It was a really great feeling to, you know, not only coming back in victory in such a short time, you know, mm-hmm. and I never had seen any of those, some of those big cities, you know, with the streets lined with the, you know, the parades and everything. Yeah. It was awesome. Yeah, yeah, it really was.
So then what happened?
Well, that was when I took off to go on a 4-year stint to Mississippi, to Camp Shelby. One of the guys that was my leader in Kentucky had taken off earlier to take a full-time position at this newly created unit there. And so he had been telling me how he liked it so much. And so I was ready for another shift. So it was an opportunity for me to increase my rank and mm-hmm. my knowledge and expertise. And so I went and took the opportunity and really, really loved that outfit. We did a lot of travel and had a lot of people coming in to see us from all medical outfits in the military came down and trained on this new equipment. So it was a lot of pride there. Yeah. And I really like Mississippi.
You could show all those other people what you were doing there, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Actually, when my unit, the 4th, 8th, and 5th, actually came down a couple of years later.
Really?
You know, and that was really a good time to really get to see them and train with your home state, you know.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Well, what did you get to use any of this knowledge in a civilian capacity? I'm thinking like in terms of hurricanes or any other major things?
Well,
where you could set it up or help somebody to set up medical?
I'd have to think back on that. I'm sure that we did. We actually had our staff in the very various capacities of DEP meds go over and help other units that were deployed using their systems and making sure everything went right and that they set it up right properly. And I personally didn't get to go on any of those missions, but let's see, they've been around since might have been right after Desert Storm they started up, and then they're still going now, but they've got a different type of mission because they kind of phased out that equipment. Maybe about 2002, maybe. You know, they were still ongoing. And I've got some contacts. Some of the original guys that I encountered in 92 have went on to other assignments. One officer, he was at the Pentagon for quite a while. Now he's back, and he's the leader of the RTS Medical Center down there. Mm-hmm. And I could get, you know, he's a wealth of knowledge as well. He could kind of get us updated on, you know, what some
Did they ever ask you in 2002 and 3 and 4 and so on when we moved into Afghanistan to come in?
Well, I was being full-time. I came back after the 18-month stint with the two other reserve medical units. I came back full-time as a recruiter, actually as a supply sergeant.
Uh-huh.
1998, the 475th MASH was disbanded, and so there was no other full-time opportunities in that career field, so I went ahead and went in recruiting after a small stint with logistics, and then stayed there for about 5 years. After that, I went full-time with the Engineer Battalion, which is now a forward support battalion out of Harrodsburg. And so when the opportunity came up for that unit, well, the demand was on Kentucky to provide task force to go over and support, mostly security and different things like that. We took our engineers and then kind of hastily trained them to do the security missions. And so they came and pulled our units. They actually mowed from Jackson, Kentucky, over near Hazard. And so we sent them a great deal of our guys over there, engineers, kind of retrained them, and they joined the task force with them and went over and ramped up. Being a full-timer and being a supply sergeant, property holder, I was on a rear detachment. They didn't really need maintenance guys. They didn't need supply guys. And so a lot of our guys didn't get to go with that mission.
What do you think about that? Were you happy that you draw the long straw or the short straw?
Well, me being a guy that wants to be where the action is,
it was
kind of bittersweet not to go. But I was thinking about my family.
How big was your family at that point?
Well, I was married and just have one son, and so
had they moved with you down to Mississippi?
No, they didn't. No, they actually stayed here the entire time. So I just commuted back and forth, you know, during that stint, mm-hmm. and so. The second, after this unit redeployed, they actually deployed twice, once out of the Jackson, and then we had another unit mission to go to Kuwait. And that was a task force where they were over some elements, joint force elements, and actually provided lodging and other logistic support for this other group to come through a camp they had over there. So there were two missions that was the rear detachment for. And we launched most of our soldiers out of Harrisburg on both of those missions. And then my third stint and final stint, I was out of Independence, a new unit formed, Aviation Support Battalion, 1204th. I retired in February. They're actually scheduled to deploy 2011. So they're in the ramping up process. New unit founded, I think, August or around June 2006. And I joined them in that process and helped, try to get them as far as they could, as far as logistics. And then they retired. Those guys, some of those guys moved on to other units, and they're actually in the process of deploying this month. And, the majority of them are ramping up to deploy in 2011.
Those folks that you were, that you didn't deploy with, did you go to the deploy ceremonies, the going away ceremonies?
No, I haven't. Participated.
Have you heard of any of those guys? Have they all come back home, or has there been any casualties that you knew in some of those groups that?
No.
Well,
no.
This one you have don't know
not
yet.
This one,
but,
yeah.
Well, no, which of these one. All these many jobs you had, which did you like the best? What's the most memorable thing?
Well, the most challenging was logistics, being assigned for and responsible
I would
for
think
all
so.
The yeah. Mm-hmm. You actually have to do a lot of manual labor, a lot of computer work, a lot of forecasting, a lot of equipment tracing and tracking, and your main job is to focus and keep the soldier ready, and part of that is to keep his equipment ready, and that was the most challenging because I had the least experience of it. But I guess the most rewarding and one I was best at was the medical equipment, having to interact with different technicians and the doctors and different ones in the hospitals and help them do their job better. That was the most satisfying, and to give them the confidence to go in and focus on the patient, without having to worry about the equipment being there and being part of the problem.
Now, why did they disband the 475th?
Good question. Because the Kentucky Guard's focus was going to more combat arms.
That's right.
Yeah. It's really expensive, and for all the training you've got to provide, for all the different varieties of jobs within a hospital, funding, funding, and the fact that the Army was going away from the larger hospitals, it came from Big Army, and Kentucky had the foresight to see that, and Big Army had more requirements to support as they draw down the divisions and save money by, shrinking the military. You have to have the reserves ready to step up in a combat arms. Before it was more services support, rear type stuff. But they were spending too much money on the rear and just wanted to get the reserves and the National Guard involved in the, the forward support. That's what's going on now, And as always, through the big conflicts, they usually go down just a little bit too much. Cut too thin, and then
they'll have to ramp up rapidly. One side to the other, the pendulum swing.
Exactly.
Well, in general, what do you think about your career? Was that a good move back along when you were 21?
Well, actually, I've always thought, not afraid to say it, I think I've been more tailored for the Air Force. If I'd had it all to do over again.
You'd like to be a fly boy.
Well, fly boy supporter. Still the same job. I had a friend here that actually, he's a few years younger than me. He's a recruiter now, full-time for the National Guard, but he came up through biomedical equipment repair school through the Air Force. And we just happened to, find each other throughout the years and see that we had a similar, job skill provided by the military. And we both had ended up in recruiting. So I had the tough job of recruiting for the Army National Guard, and he had the easy job of recruiting for the Air Force Guard. But when I told him in the hometown what the National Guard's all about, some of the frustrations he had with the Air Force, you know, it made the National Guard a little bit more appealing to him, you know. And so he's really appreciating it now. And he's still a soldier recruiting for the National Guard now. But
yeah,
both of us no longer working in the healthcare industry.
Isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
How old is your son?
My son is 27.
Has he followed his father's footsteps and gone into the military?
No. He's pretty athletic. He's just about ready to finish school. He was so focused on athletics, so blessed athletically, that he kind of got sidetracked and went through school, played 4 years, and just about ready to finish his business degree. But no, he had never had any interest in the military, and some of the disqualifiers that would prevent you from serving your country, he had a history of migraine headaches and some different things like that really would have eliminated, you know, his opportunity. Yeah.
So you got to see him grow up pretty much. You didn't have to.
I came back. When I left to go to Mississippi, he was 8 years old. And when I got back, he was 12. And he was one of the reasons. My grandmother and my mother, you know, my family were really close, and everybody was here in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And the commute was getting old, getting expensive. And so, you know, it was time for Dad to come back home, you know. So I got back just in time to, you know, help him get through there and guide him through his high school and, you know, college.
Yeah.
And so now we've got grandbabies.
Oh, well, good for you. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm,
congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, so what are you going to do with all this knowledge? You're into a new career?
Adventure. Well, as I was telling you, interesting that you had asked me about the DD-214. You know, the military has always been at the forefront of developing technology that's going to last in a combat environment. One of my new business ventures, I've joined with a company. We have a 2-gig storage device, which is actually an emergency medical ID card.
Mm.
Now, this card here stores all type of information that a person would need, just in case they were wiped out, all their hard records, say Katrina. People's homes were flooded. Some of the city archives were flooded.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't have any proof to their insurance company that they had a policy or that what Bibles they had at their home, their family photos and history, you know, all wiped
it's
out.
All in there.
You store it on this device here and can actually go back and rebuild your life. Fires in California, different things like that. But what makes it relevant to the military soldier, when they go through to ramp up and deploy, they basically have to settle their estate before they go. You know, they have all their records in place, power of attorneys, family care plans, everything, their wills. And if they're married, sometimes you go to war and situations change as
mm-hmm.
you're on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Your best friend, your wife, your loved ones
mm-hmm.
become your worst enemies.
Mm.
The will has to change. The power of attorney has to change to mm-hmm. protect the soldier's estates. So this card here is one of the ways that they can secure that. We've got another company that I'm working with as well. They help the soldier to go ahead and process online. It's a digital society, as if they were back home in country, change whatever they have to do, and then basically take that documentation, store it digitally on this card, and have it on their person at all times. So, you know,
is this already available to the guys in
Iraq
and Afghanistan?
This is a new company that launched just the first of next year, and so we're approaching the Pentagon to look at our product and see exactly how we could help the soldier out with that process.
So, will you be pushing this? Will you be going to Washington?
Well, no, actually, we've got a couple generals. Retired generals out of Fort Knox and out of the Kentucky Army National Guard. They're looking at that. They're doing their due diligence and researching it and putting in our proposal.
So all your contacts through all your military years, you're still dealing with people in the military, retired or other different versions of...
Exactly, yeah. We understand the soldier situation, being in their shoes.
Yeah.
And so with all the stress that's on the soldier, not only due to the life in the military, especially the life of the military and combat, but also due to the recession and all the stress that's going on at home as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty overwhelming sometimes. And you gotta work smart. And you gotta be ready and be prepared.
Yeah.
And so this is just another tool that can help them out, you know, in times of crisis.
Well,
they're fighting for their country.
I was looking at something one of the news reports talking about the number of returning combatants mm-hmm. who are committing suicide
yes.
or having a lot of psychological problems.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things at the time when you were over there was the Gulf War syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have, or did anybody that you knew have symptoms that...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had several soldiers that had difficulties.
And that was just for in that brief amount of time.
Yes, exactly. Very little stress.
And this is amazing. Now they're going back deployed again and again and again for long stints.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, over the years, they've improved the training and the preparation for the what they call the fog of war and the theater of operations and the calamity that can occur. They've got much better training getting them ready to do that. But then you got to multiply the over periods of time where they're doing these rotations over and over again, how it's grinding their family, stressing their family relationships, even with that good training
mm-hmm.
and that support, still, you know,
mm-hmm.
Unless a soldier is leaning on the Lord, praying on the Lord, you know, those are some of the strongest mm-hmm. soldiers that are able to not only maintain their status, but be able to take care of other soldiers, even when they're hurting or straining. You know, you hear so many stories of people breaking down and, you know, mm-hmm. not able to, they're actually attacking other soldiers. Some of the soldiers that, you know, have lean on the Lord,
mm-hmm.
have that spiritual support, they are able to maintain, you know, through all that stress and battle and still, you know, be blessed to focus on others, you know. And
did you find some religious support in when you were there?
Yes, of course, yes.
All the chaplains and all the other,
mm-hmm.
in addition to your yeah. own individuals.
Didn't have
comrades.
As many there then as they do now, and they're flooding the field with them now.
They are.
Psychologists and everything, of mm-hmm. course, because of, you know, they're looking at the feedback, you know, of what's going on and how it's taking its toll. But mm-hmm. They've always been traditionally always through the military, mm-hmm. been right there with the soldiers, you know, not mm-hmm. only for performing last rites, but to all aspects,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
on a mission.
Mm-hmm. Well, being in that medical field, when you see these TV shows about at Walter Reed, all the amazing things that can be done for people who are
mm-hmm.
now, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Victims of
yeah.
paraplegia or whatever.
Yes.
I mean, what do you think about all that? All these folks that they're able to save their lives, but now they have whole new lives that they have to
mm-hmm.
to learn.
Well, it's
without one limb or three limbs or two limbs or
yeah, they've got amazing testimonies now going on.
And some of them want to re-up.
Yeah, they do because they love it so much. Well, the technology is there to make them be able to participate in all the activities that they've had before and be exposed to even more challenges.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen so many of those stories, and it's encouraging to those of us who have been blessed to have all the full facilities
mm-hmm.
and not having lost, you know, any mental capacity or any
mm-hmm.
physical capacities.
Mm-hmm.
And but they are so inspirational. Some of the challenges that they're, because it builds such confidence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They lose their sight,
mm-hmm.
they lose their hearing, they lose the use of their limbs, you know, even total paraplegics, you know, they're still
mm-hmm.
able to use whatever they have left,
mm-hmm.
that resource to keep fighting on, and to,
mm-hmm.
it's another challenge. It's another
mm-hmm.
challenge, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it is. And, I mean, we hate to see the casualties pile up and the injuries pile up, but I think they're doing a good job of recognizing it. All the VA centers are ramping up and getting funded, and they're getting resource to take care of these soldiers when they do come back. And it's a great thing to see our country respond in that matter, because the soldiers and the military personnel are just so important, you know, to our daily lives, of which
mm-hmm.
many people take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, you sound like you just love the military.
I love people. Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah.
And you,
a lot
see,
of
you have, yeah, you seem like you have a real optimistic look on.
Yeah, I do.
On that, I guess that helps you get through. Is there any low times with the military? When last times the morale will be down, and then it'll
mm-hmm.
be back up again.
Yeah.
What was a down time for you?
Hmm. Well,
maybe there wasn't. Maybe you have had some downtime.
Of course, we all have.
Yeah.
But like I say, I just it's tough. You go back and look at some of the things that you've done in your career that you wish you'd have paid a little bit more attention to your training, and you'd be a little bit more effective teammate to your unit. Yeah, I definitely would have been aiming a little bit higher to develop myself more to really support my other troops a lot better and to lead them and provide better examples and all that. You know, if we all had to do it over again.
No. Did you ever feel like any of your superiors just weren't getting it?
Yes, of course. Because some of them don't. Even all the way up to our general, even up to our commander-in-chief. Sometimes you get that feeling that they just don't get it. Why are we here? Why are they not making this move? You know, it's easy to play the Monday morning armchair quarterback and see so many things. But doing your research, I've watched a lot of CNN documentaries, and some of them that particularly stand out in mine is Dick Rumsfeld, Man of Honor. I don't know if you've ever seen that one before. It's kind of enlightening of how much he really admired Mr. McNamara, who was over our in charge of the Vietnam War, and how he their innovative thinking and underappreciating praising for some of the generals. Got Colin Powell sitting right there. And a man has had several, you know, he's been in the fray of combat. He's lived the soldier's life, has the empathy for how our country's actions affect the rest of the world. And so it was really disappointing to not see him be more involved at, when you've got Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney and Mr. Rumsfeld. They get everything they say is heard and appreciated. But the Colin Powell, you know, I think he was underutilized. And some of the things he was trying to warn about, you know, of course, wasn't palatable to them at the time. But in hindsight, you look at some of the warnings he had for us, you know, where would we be now? You think some of the things that are occurring right now as we're going through our economic struggles and, you know, the plot and the attacks that were planned by the terrorists headed by Osama bin Laden, you know, and you just wonder if we might have been a little bit more focused and where would have led us. Of course, you know, here we are, though. And
did you ever get to meet anybody like Colin Powell or
Schwarzenegger? Just read
Why
their books.
Why do I keep calling him Schwarzenegger? I don't know.
Norman Schwarzkopf.
Norman Schwarzkopf.
Norman.
Storm
you had to,
and Norm.
You had to love him, yeah. But General Petraeus and you know, different ones of the generals, and I mean, so you can go on and on and on. The generals not allowed to, you know, they've got a timeline of when they can write their books and tell the story, but you know. It really hurts to not get their perspective and let them, you know, share some of the things. And but you know, it is politics. It really, you know, it's the if we had opportunity to have some of our leaders be there for a longer period of time, you know, and develop the visions that they have, you know, Republican or Democrat, you know, I think the consensus would be there, and we as a country would work together, and that would take a lot less the burden off of the military to be able to provide the liberty and support and freedom that we all enjoy and is our goal to have. So,
what was it like to be a military and know that the Pentagon was hit?
Oh, very surprising. Very surprising, yeah.
Did you know anybody that was in there at the time?
No, I'm pretty sure I did, but I just haven't, you know, reconnected or actually got back. And you're so busy, you know, I just retired in February. The up tempo of all of the full-time personnel and even the part-time personnel, they have the full-timers you know, really have to they're really overwhelmed with information, with tasks, with missions, with training, with everything, having to be there as a small team all the ways preparing for the bigger units and battalions and, you know, all to come together and make their training plans come to realization. And it's just really, really difficult on all aspects of the administration, the training, the planning guys, the logistic guys, and then the officers that have to, you know, absorb all the new programs that are being implemented all the time. And, you know, at the same time, get ready to deploy and, you know, help the soldiers focus on what their main mission is. It's just really, really tough. And even for in this digital age, they reach out and touch these M-Day traditional soldiers who normally would come in, you know, once a month. They're being, you know, hit with assignments all the time, doing the regular month where they should be with their family and focus on their jobs and everything like that. You know, they have a database where they reach out and have the soldiers, you know, engage and, you know, getting it planted that seed, you know, to really, really get ready, you know, because we could be called at any time, you know. So you got to make sure your personal life is, you know, ready, and make sure you're ready to lead your troops on your mission, your section, training and all that stuff. And it's I mean, it's not hard to get the soldiers' attention anymore because it happens so much around them. If it hasn't happened to them, then yeah, they're fully engaged, you know, and see why. But back in the day, there were a very small percentage of troops in the National Guard that had, you know, opportunity to become veterans, fully qualified veterans. But now it's not uncommon anymore at all. It's actually it's the norm.
When you were doing the recruiting, I was just watching something on television where I think an Army recruiting center up in Philadelphia has been completely turned over into a game thing for 13 and 14 year old kids.
Yeah.
That's a whole new way of recruiting, isn't
serious.
It? What is your opinion about that? Or do you know much about that?
Well, I haven't heard about that particular center, but I know that in the Air Force, they're saving tons and tons of money of training their pilots virtually instead of going up, taking the chance of risking the aircraft, burning all the fuel. and it's making them a lot better. The combat pilots they have, actually it was pertaining to flying the drones. The unmanned aircraft.
That was on there.
Some of the best. Yeah, you saw that too, right?
That's amazing. I don't think I realized that
they were in Nevada, and targets were in
Afghanistan.
The number one guy has never been affiliated with military. He just came up, you know, through that generation, learning all this stuff, and he's training the actual fighter pilots to convert over to be able to do this technology. And he is so good, one of the best, you know. But he's a civilian. And he's got his training coming up through those video games. And so they see how effective it is, how cost efficient it is. And that's just the way to fly these days. And I actually got to visit some of the simulators. They do the same thing in Fort Knox with armor. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, how does that affect recruiting then? When they're doing this soft sell, they say, in Philadelphia on these 13, 14-year-olds, it's free games and everything. And, of course, they have all of the posters or the idea about joining the Army when you're of age. But
that's right. It's the psychology of marketing. You know, capitalists have been using it for years, and it works. It's going to make their jobs really easy. Actually, one of the best recruiters that I knew at the time, when I was recruiting from 98 to 2002, he was using video game simulators in his office. PlayStation in his office. And he used a little NASCAR. He had a little office over there in Eastern Kentucky. And he made Chiefs 50. He was the best recruiter in Kentucky at that particular time. And that's what
Does he attribute it to it? Really?
He told everybody what it was. And now a lot of the recruiters use that. They use all the technology. Exactly. It's amazing.
Recruiting has a lot to do with the economy at the time too, doesn't it?
It sure does. Yeah, all those factors come into play. Yeah, they haven't been able to. You're seeing the bonuses kind of teeter off now, as they weren't. They peaked, I guess, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But as the recession hit, you know, funds kind of dried up a little bit. That's huge.
But it's still, when you have 10% unemployment, there's an opportunity there.
Yeah, I mean, the college students come out, they have these huge amounts of college debt racked up, and There's no jobs out there for them. Mm-hmm. You know, and the military offers bonus money up front, you know, cash, and then you also have up to $20,000 of your college debt paid for. You know, that's huge. You know, they see a nest egg and they step up and meet the challenge. Mm-hmm. But the bad thing is that the standards are so high in all the areas of criteria that a person has to meet to be eligible for the military. You know, a lot of people that like shun the turn their nose up at the military opportunity before, and then when it really looks valuable, when it really got their focus, they're ready to jump into it, they're not qualified. So that's a sad thing about recruiting. Wow. You see somebody really motivated, really ready for it, could really help the military, mm-hmm. whether it's medical, whether it's trainability, whether it's legal, some kind of issue. You know, they either have to get a waiver from the Pentagon, the NGB, National Guard Bureau, and you know, they have to be at the mercy of that decision and whether or not they
can. Timing is everything in this world.
Timing is everything.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
it really is. Mm-hmm. Well, is there something that I haven't asked you? You actually were in Bolivia and Puerto Rico with
mm-hmm. with the dental unit. Yeah,
with the dental unit. Did you have to learn some Spanish?
We probably picked up a little bit, yeah.
But you didn't have to have it for your...
No. We just went up there and set up.
How long was that? Oh, so
it was only a 2-week, we called it a dental humanitarian mission up there at Lake Titicaca.
Really?
Yeah, it wasn't that far from La Paz, Bolivia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting country.
Air sickness? What do you call it? Altitude sickness?
No, I didn't have any trouble up there.
That's pretty
It was pretty nice little vacation paid for by the military.
Oh.
And the people were so appreciative. And then they've done those in Latin America, in Eastern Kentucky, different places, you know.
Exactly.
Going around.
What was it then? You set it up and then the civilians mm-hmm. used it?
No. We took our dentists with us.
Oh.
Yeah. And their dental technicians, the hygienists, whatever. And the main mission there... was to pull teeth. They were chewing these coca leaves and different things, you know, just one of the things that they do. And their teeth would go all recess or just get worn down all the way to the gum line. And so they'd have to go in and just pull those teeth, you know. Yeah, I think it's the chemical reaction that actually worn the enamel mm-hmm. down, you know. And
mm-hmm.
so. Yeah, they were so thrilled to get those teeth pulled out.
whose idea was that? Was that a goodwill gesture?
Yes.
That's mm-hmm. and somebody.
And it's good training for us. You know,
mm-hmm.
we really needed to get familiarized and gain confidence and use this equipment. Mm-hmm. Those people needed our assistance, so you know, someone negotiated for us to go up there and assist these people.
What was the problem in Puerto Rico that you were trying to help
solve? That was the Puerto Rican National Guard. We went down there and helped them train on their equipment.
Oh.
They've been assigned all this new equipment. They never had used it. They weren't allowed to open mm-hmm. it up and actually train with it until they were actually qualified. So that's what we did down there. It was a 3-week stint.
Oh, mm-hmm. 3 weeks in San Juan, huh?
Oh.
That's tough, isn't it?
We're actually at a naval base that is actually closed now. Roosevelt Rules. Naval base, and it's probably 30 to 40 miles from San Juan. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty interesting trip. 75 degrees every day. Not bad.
Mm-hmm. So now that Puerto Rican unit, is that a National Guard unit?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so they're deployed somewhere using this equipment or these skills, or is that something?
They have the opportunity, yes. Then, you know, those systems went away now, of course, but I'm pretty sure that they were, you know, doing the same thing that some of our other units did.
Don't think of the territories having National Guard units that are deployed, but I guess
exactly.
That's part of the...
Yeah, they're part of the... That's one of the 51st states.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's
mm-hmm.
right.
And they're really good.
Yeah. They are?
They're really sharp, yeah. They perform very well, traditionally. Mm-hmm.
Well, what haven't I asked you that you wanted to tell me?
Well, I think I've told you more than enough. Like I said, I was coming out getting a filler. I would actually like to be a recruiter for you to... gain access to some other veterans who the time may be running out on to actually go down and get them comfortable with you coming out to interview them or
mm-hmm.
Or vice versa, getting them to come here
mm-hmm.
and because I know just top of my head a bunch of guys in all branches of the service, you know, whether through golf or, you know, just different affiliations.
We'd love to have that connection.
Okay. I'll assist
wonderful.
You, you know, whatever you
want
to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.